I don't know what's wrong with me, but I find myself constantly reading the most ridiculous articles. I don't know why that is. I think that'll explain why I got a third at university. I think I got my third because I spent my time just reading appallingly. And this was one of the things that I read, this article recently, and it just typifies my reading habits. This is the lost property that was handed into British Rail depots a couple of years ago. Let me read it to you. To my astonishment, at the top of this list was a human brain that was left by a medical student who took it on an away day and left it on the train. That's amazing, isn't it? You might call that the ultimate in absent-mindedness, I don't know. And it makes interesting reading this list. There's also a pair of stuffed gerbils, a glass eye, a motorcycle, and a wooden leg. And the mind boggles to think if the same person left all of them. That's all I can say. Well, I'd like you, by contrast, very much now to use your minds and engage in a small exercise for me. And this is the exercise. Henry Ford said, thinking is probably the hardest work that there is, which is why so few people engage in it. But could you put your mind to this question this Thursday lunchtime? Here's the question. Do you think that you're a successful person? Do you think you're a successful person? And I'm not saying have you been in the past or do you think that you will be, but right now, do you think you're a successful person? Now, I suppose if we're honest, we'd have people ranging at every possible spectrum there. There'd be some people who'd be fairly certain they're successful and others who've been put down so often their confidence is rock bottom. And most of us, I guess, would be hovering around somewhere in the middle. Well, there comes before us in this Bible passage this lunchtime a man who, from every point of view, would have been considered successful. And yet, can I read it through and can we see what God's judgment on him was? So let me, as we think of this question, what is success, let me read you this little passage. This is a parable that Jesus taught, and I'll start again at the top. What is success? So do you think you're successful? Let's see what we make of this bloke. And it's on the yellow sheets in front of you, if you can all see it. I'd love just to throw this little striking parable out from the lips of Jesus in Luke chapter 12, one of the Gospels. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Jesus replied, "Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you?" Then he said to them, "Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I'll store all my grains and my goods. And I'll say to myself, you've plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry." But God said to him, "You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you've prepared for yourself? This is how it will be for anyone who stores up things for himself, but is not rich towards God." Well, can you see that God's obituary on this man is very short, verse 20. It's only two words, "You fool." And interestingly, in the Greek, the word Jesus uses for this fool literally means without thought. That's the Greek meaning of the word. So it's not that he didn't think at all. He did. He made plans. He sat down. He thought and thought and thought. But God says his life was a dismal failure because he didn't think about the right things. That was the problem. He didn't think about the really important questions of life. So let's just think about what constitutes success and failure in this little striking parable. And can I just say, in case you think it is rather rude, I think that it had to be pretty striking, pretty stopping in your tracks, because up until now, there's been a huge discussion on eternity in Luke chapter 12. So verse 5, we're told, "Fear him who after killing the body has power to throw you into hell." Well, that's a pretty striking thing to say. Verse 2, it's a bit like Maximus in Gladiator. Jesus says, there's nothing concealed that will not be disclosed. It's a bit like what we do in Life Echoes in Eternity. Verse 8, Jesus has warned that the future belongs to this figure, the Son of Man. So that's been the talk all on eternity. And suddenly, verse 13, can we look down? Can we see the huge bang that comes in? Verse 13, someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." So Jesus is talking about eternity, and this bloke says, "Will you shut up with that namby-pamby religious eternal rubbish? You just tell my brother to divide the inheritance." So here are two brothers falling out for good over the will. over who gets Granny's sideboard and clock. Do you have that? Do you know that in your family? I tell you, there's a relationship in my family that for decades has been sour over the will. It certainly can happen. So this man is absorbed by his possessions. He can't be doing with Jesus' teaching. And so Jesus says in verse 15, a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. And then he arrests us with this story. And he's trying to say, listen, will you keep the writ in your pocket? Here's a bloke, isn't it? He's sort of got a writ in his pocket that he's about to serve against his brother that's going to ruin relations for good. And Jesus says, keep the writ in your pocket. Let's work out what's really important. And this is the story he tells. Let's have a look. Verse 16. We learn that this man was a successful farmer. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. So this guy knows how to work the EU subsidies. The stables have been converted into garages, and there are not two family cars, but four. Because he's got twins, you know, and they both want to have a little car of their own. So he's got one. The lady of the house has got one, and the twins have got one. And if we wanted to put him in city terms, he's one of the thousands who commutes in from Surrey. So he'll be sitting there in the first class reading the Financial Times. Sorry if you do commute in from Surrey, it's only a story. I don't mean to offend you as I say that. And if you were in his carriage as he commuted in from, as you came into the city, you see, even at this present, you know, place at the moment with the FTSE 100, wherever it is, the person next to you would be giving you a nudge and saying, now look at him. He's made a fortune, you know, this bloke. Made an absolute fortune. Listen to his advice. He's no fool. Watch what he does. Verse 17, can we look down? On we go. He thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. Then he said, this is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I'll store all my grain and my goods. So that's what he does. Now you see, you can see what happens, haven't you? You know, he's got a much better harvest than was expected 1 year, but there's no panic, there's no waste. He's not going to flood the market. So he gets out his calculator, he does his sums, he gets in as an accountant. He works out the right course of action, which is to actually pay for the storage of this grain mountain. I mean, after all, waste not, want not, that's what his mother taught him. And there's a bigger profit this year, and he's not going to give it to the tax man. And so he plans and he works it all out, and then he's able to say wonderfully in verse 19, can we see what he's able to say? You've plenty of good things laid up for many years, take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry. So he retires at 45, this guy. And the Times would doubtless do a colour feature on him, entitled, The Man Who Knew When to Stop. So here he is, you see. He's actually made it onto the rich list. He's on the rich list. And everyone is sitting in their front rooms in suburbia, and they're still commuting in. And they're reading the article about him, and they're saying, very wise, very wise. And actually, you know, he's bought a lovely big house down at Rye on the coast, and overlooking the golf course and the sea. It's a huge great mansion where he's going to spend his time, but of course he's going to keep his Chelsea house as well. And he intends to join Rye and get his handicap down to single figures. That's what he's going to do with his retirement. He'll remain a member of Dulwich. But that's all, of course, what makes verse 20 so brutal, doesn't it? You see what God says about him, because I wonder if you can imagine how it works. You see, the retirement party has come, and it's the end of it. They're all down at Rye. And they're overlooking the sea in this wonderful big house. And his wife is with the staff in the kitchen as they clear up. And he is standing on the veranda with a cool glass of, what do you think, orange juice perhaps, as he's overlooking the sea. And the congratulations of his friends are still ringing in their ears. In fact, they're all lamenting. You see, they've all got to drive back up to town. It's a Sunday afternoon. They've all got to get back into the slog of things Monday morning, but not him. And he's standing there thinking, I've done it. And as you look down on his little side shelf on the table there, there are some skiing holidays there. And actually, do you know they're thinking of buying a chalet in Val d'Isère because they want to go skiing three times a year. And then there's some safaris. They're going to go on safari, really do some wonderful safaris in Kenya, go up to the Aberdares, have a wonderful time of it. And he's sitting there looking at all this, and he says to himself, "You've done it. For 20 years, you'd always planned to retire early, and you've done it. Take life easy. Eat, drink." And suddenly there's a searing pain in his chest, and he is dead before they get him to intensive care in Canterbury. Verse 20. But God said to him, "You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you prepared for yourself?" Well, the memorial service for him is held in some large church in the city, perhaps St. Botolph's or St. Helens. And there's a speech by the chairman, and he says what a loyal servant of the company he was. And the trade journal will say what an example he was to his profession. And again, verse 20, if we look down, God will say, "You fool." And I'm taking a funeral of someone like this, and I've taken their funerals. And on the 6th of August 1983, my godfather was killed, and he was just like this. So don't think this doesn't walk straight out of my life. It does. And what happens to all the money? Where did all the money go? Well, the lawyers tidied most of it up. Do you see, if we look down, then who will get what you've provided? Sorry, are there lawyers here? I'm so sorry. Can I say, if there are any lawyers here who commute in from Surrey, I'm really not trying to offend you at all. And the lawyers tidy most of it up, but, you know, he's got a useless son. He's an absolute wastrel, this son. And the son breaks his mother's heart and spends all the money in 12 years. Just spends a lot of it. That's who gets what he prepared for himself. So it's gone, the money. And where is he in terms of eternity? Well, do we see those last words? He's not rich towards God. So all was lost. Well, I don't know what you think of that, but do you reckon that the brother who had the writ in his pocket may have kept the writ in his pocket and said, actually, there may be other things that are more important at this point in time? I think it would probably stopped him. I think it would have stopped me, whatever I was thinking. And I just want to finish and say there are two fatal mistakes that this bloke made. I'm seeing him on Sunday night, actually. I had a guy, he's a delightful bloke. He's a school teacher, and he's just lost his brother, and he loved his brother to bits. But his brother really wasn't a man who in any way bothered with the Christian faith, and we're doing a funeral for him. And his brother was a super bloke, but had never bothered, really. And I guess that's partly why I'm speaking on this, because it hits you. And I can tell you at the funeral, I'm not going to say anything nasty like this, but it's in my mind a bit. And the two fatal mistakes that this bloke made, let me give you the two of them. The first mistake he made, you see, is that he lived as though God wasn't there. Now, we don't know much about this bloke. We don't know if he was a good husband or a philanderer. We don't know if he was a good father or he beat his children. We just know, end of verse 21, that he was not rich towards God. Now, I don't doubt if you'd stopped him in the street, he probably wouldn't have time, he'd be going so quickly. But if you'd stopped him in the street and you said, "Do you believe in God?" he'd have said, "Yes, of course I believe in God." But you see, he lived as though God wasn't there. Can we look down and see that? You see, verse 19, he's absolutely self-centered. Well, we'll go from 17. You see, he uses the words I, my, or myself 11 times. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods, and I'll say to myself." You see, he thought he was self-sufficient, but actually he was self-centered. Samuel Butler wrote about two people who were very selfish, Mr. and Mrs. Carlyle, and he said this: "How good of God to let Carlyle and Mrs. Carlyle marry one another, and so make two people miserable instead of four." And do you know, self-centered people are such a bore. And this bloke is absolutely wrapped up. You see, he's got it all for himself, verse 19. He's got treasure, plenty of good things. He's got leisure, take life easy. He's got pleasure, eat, drink, and be merry. But what about God, the giver of it all? Well, I think if you'd asked him about God, he'd have said, "Well, it's on the back burner." And this will sound desperately sexist. It's not meant to sound sexist. But I guess if you'd asked him, "What do you think about God?" he'd have said, "Well, I think religion's for, you know, the wife and children. It's a good framework for them." I think he might have said that. There are a lot of people who believe that. Or they'd say, "Well, you know, it is for people who can't cope. And it's patently obvious to the world that I can cope." And God said to him, "What a fool you are." Now, why is he a fool? He's a fool because God is there, and he has revealed himself to us. That's why he's a fool. You know, in June last year, I was asked by my mother, who's a very dominant lady, but I was asked by my mother to babysit my brother's three kids. My brother and my sister-in-law were away for the day at a wedding, so I had to babysit. Then Patrick is six, Dalton's eight, and Lena Joy is 3.5. And I began at 10 in the morning, and it was through till 7 in the evening. Can I tell you, it's absolutely exhausting. And we visited the ducks, you know, we did the whole eating bit. The swings, football, rugby, I mean, it went on and on. Someone should have told me at bath time, "It's quite helpful if you take most of your clothes off as well." I mean, I couldn't believe it. I got absolutely drenched. But about 5 in the afternoon, Lena Joy, the little 3.5-year-old, said she wanted to play hide and seek. And her brothers were both having a sleep. And I said, "Lena, that's fine, I'd love to play, but have you found this with little children? You tend to have to get the rules clear before you start. because otherwise if there's a ruling in the middle of the game, I found it tends to go against you. So I said to Lena, what are the rules? And she said, it's easy. She said, you hide your face and begin to count. I run away and hide behind the dining room door and you come and look for me. I said, Lena, have I got that right? I hide my face, I count to 10, you hide behind the dining room door and then I come and look for you. I said, is that correct? She said, yes, it is. It's not a terribly difficult game. So I counted to 10. I said, is Lena, where is she? Is she behind the fridge? Whoops of laughter from behind the dining room door. Is she under Mummy and Daddy's bed? Uncontrollable laughter from behind the dining room door. Is she behind the dining room door? And she shot out like she was spring-loaded. Now, the issue with Lena was, you see, she wanted to be found. That's why she spoke. The whole thing on hide-and-seek was, you've got to be found. And she thinks I'm so dim. She needed to give me all the help on finding out she could. Now, can I say, with God, God is not hiding. He has spoken, and he wants to be found. And he's spoken through Jesus Christ, and he wants us to find him here as he walks off the pages of Mark's Gospel. Someone said to me a couple of years ago, they said, Rico, I've been looking for God for years, but I've not found him. And I said, I just find that impossible to believe. He wants to be found. He's spoken. And not only that, he sent his son to die so that we could find him, so that we could be forgiven what we've done wrong. That's why Jesus dies on the cross and pays in death and blood for all the times we have done a verse 19 and said, look, I'll just be utterly self-centered. And so he's died that we can be forgiven. And yet people say, you can't find him. Can I assure you, you can. We run a course called Christianity Explored, and God does want us to find him. But that's the first thing. He lives as though there's no God, and that's a desperate thing because God is there and he's speaking to us. And I don't know what you think of that, which is why we run this Christianity Explored course. So those things can be discussed. We're not taking for granted that anyone believes them. But the second thing, and I finish right now with this because I know you've got to go, and thank you for making time for coming. But the second thing is, he doesn't just live as though there's no God. He also lives as though there's no death and no judgment. You know, that is the desperate thing. My problem is, don't tell me anything, because I always work out my psychological problems in front of people. I'm absolutely screwed up. But my problem is, the desperate thing about this memorial service I'm taking is that you know, this super guy did live as though there was no death and no judgment. You see, this man lived here, we've got down, with a framework for living that missed out what he couldn't change. And what he couldn't change is verse 20, can we see? But God said to him, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. And then what will come to each of us from the giver of life? So he's demanding our life from us. In other words, he's saying, look, what have you done with your life? He's saying, did we know each other? Did we ever become friends? That's what God's asking. And what about your sin? Was it ever forgiven? Now, the agonizing thing here is that you see, life does get faster and faster. At the funeral services, as you stand at the graveside, you say these words from Psalm 103. As for man, his days are like grass. He flourishes like the flower of the field. Yes, he does. But the rich blow, the wind blows in its place and remembers it no more. You'll go back to work and there'll be many people that are flourishing, and I don't begrudge them that at all. I don't begrudge them flourishing. I just want them to know God and to know his forgiveness. And life does get faster. Do you know this rhyme? To my dentures I'm accustomed, to my deafness I'm resigned. I can cope with my bifocals, but oh, I miss my mind. That was written by an elderly person. And you know, we do get older, and it's amazing how death hits us. All of us here, I think once we get to our 30s, have friends that we've lost. I have here the school register of the school I was at. And as I look through this list, Tim Dickin is dead, Simon Duffett is dead, Frank Calvelli is dead. Ben Summers is dead, Justin Taylor is dead, Alex Ricketts is dead. And they were all mates. Life is very short. And God doesn't want any of us to be unwise or unsuccessful. He wants us all, can we see, to be rich towards him. God longs to know us. He longs for us to be successful. But he is saying, listen, will you therefore live in reference to me? So let me finish and say, look, can I ask this morning, with all humility, I really do, but from this parable, is your life successful by God's standards? I mean, I don't know where you want to judge it from, but is it successful by God's standards? And that means, do you have a relationship with him? That's what we're all about as a church. we're longing that we'd know that. And I guess deep down what I'm saying as I say that is, we think the most precious thing about all of you is you have a soul. You're not just flesh and blood. There is a soul, and that soul is made to know the God who made you. And we're longing that you'll connect up with that God and be rich towards him. And again, he's longing to know us. He sent his son that we can know him. And I hope you'll take the opportunity from Christianity Explored to do that. Well, these are hard words, but again, I think you'll as I've gone through them, you'll see that they're very sobering. I find this passage, whenever I read it, is sobering. But there's nothing more important than our soul. And I think that's what we're saying.